The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 293.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. I hope you're well. I hope you're enjoying your weekend. Welcome to this Sunday's live stream. Got my Rebel Capitalist t-shirt on, got in the Fed hat, something everyone should have in their attire, in their wardrobe. Before we get going today, I want to shoot over to Rebel Capitalist Live. I've been speaking with a couple speakers that we don't have up on the site yet, but I wanted to remind everyone to cruise over there and get your tickets ASAP before it fills up. We've got guest speakers. Ron Paul, G. Edward Griffin, Kiyosaki, Chris Cole, Kenny McElroy, Lynn Alden, Jason Hartman, Joseph Wang. If you don't know who Joseph is, he used to work at the Federal Reserve. He was in charge of the New York Fed's trading desk. So what that means is he was the person that actually did quantitative easing. When Ben Bernanke would need to buy $60, $80 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities or treasuries from XYZ banks, it was Joseph that would print the bank reserves and denominate it in dollars and buy those mortgage-backed securities or those assets from the banks to actually execute the quantitative easing. He was the guy that did QE. So if you want to talk about someone that understands the plumbing and how it works and how you can leverage that information to help build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. He's definitely a guy, my great, great friend, Lynette Zhang. Simon's going to be there, the uneducated economist who's probably the most self-educated person I've ever seen in my life. My good friend, Mark Moss, and a couple other people that we're going to be announcing that will absolutely blow your mind. So if you haven't yet, check out Rebel Capitalist Live at Rebel Capitalist Live. com. Okay, let's get into your questions. What do we have today? Will they dump Social Security soon? No, they're not going to dump Social Security soon, Lucy, but you have to ask yourself, how are you defining dump? I assume you're talking about a default. So then the question becomes, how would they default? Well, they can just flat out not pay people. That's probably not going to happen. Or what they can do is they can just print the money to pay people, which most likely would devalue the savings of the existing dollars or currency units that are revolving, circulating on the balance sheets of non-bank entities in the real economy. There is no free lunch. So whether they just default by flat out not paying it back or they default by creating inflation, they're stealing it from somebody. Or they're not paying it back or they're stealing it to pay back from savers and from the poor and middle class. Why? Because they're the ones that usually, you guys know, understand the savings argument, of course. But as far as the poor and middle class, because they are disproportionately affected negatively by inflation, because so much of what is involved in the CPI, as far as consumer prices, revolve around food, energy, and these are a much larger portion of someone's income that makes $40,000 a year compared to someone that makes $4 million. So that person at $4 million, yes, they're going to have those same expenses, but they're such a small portion of their overall income, they're still going to have plenty of money left over to buy assets, which hopefully are going up at a faster rate than the rate of inflation. And that's why we see this continual divide that's getting worse and worse and worse between the rich and the poor and the middle class. That's why it's hollowing out the middle class. I mean, I can sit here and talk to you about just my own experience anecdotally. When I lived in Phoenix back in 2007, 2008, as an example, I was going to try to say this in a way that didn't sound a little elitist, but one of my vices has always been cars. So when I've made a little bit of money, That's kind of my guilty pleasure, if you will. So I had a guilty pleasure car back in 2007, 2008, when I lived in Phoenix. It was called a Lamborghini, and it was a Lamborghini Gallardo. And so what's my point? Back then, it was very rare to see someone with another exotic car like that, even in Scottsdale. Very, very rare. This Saturday, I went to a little cars and coffee meetup in North Scottsdale. Now, fast forward to 2021, and there were literally hundreds of Ferraris, Lamborghinis, McLarens, Rolls-Royce, Bugatti, Pagani. And for those of you who are car guys and gals, you'll know those brands well. I've never seen that many exotic high-end cars in one place in my entire life. And if you would have done that same event back in 2008, as an example, you might have had 20 cars show up, and at the most. And at this event, if I had to guess, there was probably 200 or 300. I mean, 10 times what you would have had back in 2008. Now, why that's interesting is because today I went to the state fair. And last night I went to Monster Jam, the monster trucks, right? And what's weird is you see far more people who are quote unquote rich, but then you see far more people who I would categorize is on the lower end of the economic totem pole when you go to an event like Monster Jam, or especially the state fair. But you don't see anyone in the middle. Like that, the middle class is gone, for all I can tell. It's either you own assets or you don't, or you own assets or you don't. And if you do own assets, then your purchasing power is increased significantly, although you have access to fewer goods and services. But if you were unfortunate enough to not own assets at the beginning of 2019, I mean, you're in a bad spot right now, because there is no way your income has gone up with the rate of the stuff that you're buying daily. So my point there is that, will they dump Social Security soon? No, I don't think that they'll just flat out default in an honest way. I think that they will default by devaluing the currency, by creating inflation, which will just exacerbate the problem that I saw this weekend, and just in my own personal experience, where there was far more of a middle class in 2007 and 2008, right here in Phoenix. And today it's nothing. Either you're just ridiculously rich, or you're barely scraping by, from what I can see. And that'll get worse. It'll get worse because there is no free lunch. And if the government spends all this money and the Fed monetizes it, and we send out stimmy checks, we pay people to stay home, and we give them purchasing power without having them produce any goods and services, this is what you get. This is what you get. This is what we should expect. How can I apply blackjack to my business in which I buy, sell commodities? Well, the reason you learn blackjack and apply it to business is so you understand probabilities and you understand having an edge. And you've got to set up your business so you have a mathematical edge. But I don't know your business well, but I'm assuming that would apply to what you're doing with buying and selling commodities. And that's why it's so important to understand blackjack. It's to get your mind thinking in a way that is conducive to having an edge long term. And if you want an example of why this is important, because I mean, think about how many people in trading or in investing, the conclusion they draw as to whether or not an investment or a trade was successful is based on if you made money or not. Well, if that were true, think about that in terms of blackjack. So if you hit on a 19 and you get a 2, then you get blackjack, then most likely you would have won, right? And so based on your definition of a good investment being one in which you win money, then by that definition, hitting on a 19 in that example would have been the smart decision. But we know that's insanity. We know that even if you win, that was a dumb move. And if you do that move over and over and over again, you're going to lose. You're going to go bust. And so that's probably the first key, the first lesson from blackjack that you can use, whether it's investing in commodities or whatever your business is to understand that it's not about making money or losing money at the end of the day. It's about playing the game well. If you play the game well, you have a mathematical edge. And if you have a mathematical edge, you have the law of large numbers on your side. And if you do that, the longer you stay in the game, the higher the probability that you will win. And whether it's investing, trading, business, that's the number one thing that you can learn from blackjack. Can you walk through the T accounts when a borrower defaults on a bank? If a bank creates money, then how is it negatively impacted by the borrower's default? Whenever you're trying to think through money and how it works and how it's created and how it's destroyed, I would strongly suggest, first and foremost, thinking about the balance sheets of the entities involved in the transaction. So let's go through this thought experiment. You have a bank that has assets and liabilities. Let's just say they have one loan as an asset, and it's for, let's just say $1,000, and they have a liability or liabilities in the form of deposits that are also $1,000. So if an individual were to default on that loan, is that loan still worth $1,000? And therefore they have negative equity. That means they're insolvent because their liabilities exceed their assets. So I think maybe that was kind of the first step to answering your question. The second step sounds like you're asking, well, if banks do create dollars out of thin air, then why do they need to be paid back? Why can't they just create their own dollars? Okay, well, let's also think that one through. When they, in terms of the balance sheet. So when they create a loan, those dollars go into your account. So let's just say that you bank with Wells Fargo and you take out a loan, or you get a loan for $500,000 to buy a house, a mortgage. Well, Wells Fargo says, okay, we'll give you the $500,000 and we will go ahead and deposit it into your account. So those $500 have just been created by the bank out of thin air. That those dollars did not exist before. So, but there's going to be an offsetting asset on the bank's balance sheet, and that's the loan itself. That's something they can sell. That's a future stream of cash flow plus interest, or a future stream of cash flow, I guess, is the basic way to look at it. So you're not in a negative equity position. You've got $500,000 in assets. You have $500,000 in liabilities. If the bank, it can't really lend itself money. That's the problem. It can't really give a loan to itself. It could loan, I guess, money to another bank, but then they're getting bank reserves. It gets a little weird there. But I think my best piece of advice is to always think through how it's affecting the balance sheets, right? And then let's take it as, actually, I should probably go back here. Let's take it a step further. When you buy the house, then you transfer the $500,000 that's in your account. It's a liability of the bank that just created the loan. You transfer that $500,000, let's say, to the seller's bank. And let's assume for a moment they have a different bank. So what would Wells Fargo do? They would take that $500,000 liability and they would transfer it to, let's say, Bank of America. Well, Bank of America isn't just going to take that liability because now they're insolvent. Now they have more liabilities than they have assets. So Wells Fargo would have to transfer them a $500,000 asset to back up that liability they just sent them. So they would send them most likely $500,000 worth of bank reserves. Okay, so the bank reserves go over as an asset, the dollars go over as a liability. So then the balance sheet works out for the lending bank, the balance sheet works out for the bank of the seller, the seller's balance sheet works, and the buyer's balance sheet works. You see, that's how I really think that stuff through, to not only answer this question, but to answer questions like this that you may have in the future.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
When there's a financial reset or collapse, would you pay online bills such as credit cards? Would they be allowed to pile on the interest if you had no way of paying them? I'm not sure I follow this. I mean, is your question if there's a great reset or something like that, will they wipe out credit card debt? Think about the balance sheets again. So your credit card debt is an asset of the credit card company, or who knows if they sold it. Bottom line, of a financial institution, it's an asset of that financial institution. So if you default on that, then they're going to have more liabilities, very likely. Of course, they've got a cushion there, but they may have more liabilities than assets. That puts them into a very difficult, compromising position. This is another reason why mark-to-market accounting was such a key component of the GFC, by the way. So, you know, that's going to mean that there's a lot of financial entities that take a big hit. And is the government going, or the Fed probably more likely, going to buy that debt at 100 cents on the dollar, even though they've taken a huge haircut by you not paying back the debt? I think it depends. I think it really depends. It depends on where the stock market is, what it's doing as a result of the collapse. Assuming it's down, then yes, they may step in. They may bail things out. Because like we were talking about earlier with those commercial bank balance sheets having negative equity, the Fed, you know, they go bust because they actually have to abide by GAAP accounting, where the central banks don't necessarily go bust, I think. And I was talking to Richard Werner about this on my show the other day, where we were saying, you know, can the Fed have negative equity? Can the ECB, can the BOJ? Probably. Richard Werner seems to believe they can. So that's a bank that doesn't matter if they get paid back or not, because they can just make their own money. The commercial banks can't do that. The Fed can. So I guess my point there is if it's a bank that's currently responsible for creating a lot of dollars, then they're most likely going to get bailed out because the system is so financialized. If they are holding the bag on that credit card debt, who knows what type of derivative that is. And, you know, I don't know. But I think that's how I'd look through it. You know, as far as the risk of a bank going under, if that many people defaulted on credit card debt, if they were holding the bag, how systemically important are they to the creation of future dollars? And that will give you the probability that they will be bailed out. Oh, I'd give anything to interview Thomas Sowell. Yeah, I don't think he does too many interviews now. That, I mean, it's got to be over 85 or so, but I'd absolutely love to interview Thomas Sowell. Is the crash likely to start before Christmas? You can't know these things. It goes back to blackjack. That's the one thing. We don't try to predict price direction or crashes or anything like that. The only question that is answerable is an asset cheap or is it expensive? Or is the stock market cheap or is it expensive? Is the stock market in a bubble or is it not in a bubble? Those are questions that can be answered. As far as, is it going to crash before Christmas? That cannot be answered. So I think it's fun to go through thought experiments, but as far as using those conclusions to invest, personally, I don't do that. What should someone's strategy be to buy real estate during the next 12 months? I can't really give you a specific strategy, Neo, because I don't know you. I got a lot of missing information. I don't know what your income looks like. I don't know what your balance sheet looks like. One thing I can tell you, though, is someone's strategy should include 30-year fixed rate debt. That's kind of the no-brainer. Aside from that, I can't really give you any advice, but if it were me, any strategy that I would have would include 30-year fixed rate debt, if assuming the asset I was buying was denominated in dollars. Would there be a state where all libertarians live? That'd be pretty cool. I'm all for it. Show me where is the state? Afghanistan is a libertarian paradise. Some comments and questions that you see get so old because they're just completely ridiculous. This is one. Sorry, my friend, but got to call you out on that one. The other one that's just utterly ridiculous is we shouldn't value freedom more than we value safety, because just look at a DUI law. Well, are you saying, George, that we should give people the freedom to go slam a fifth of whiskey and just go out and drive and kill people? Where's their freedom to live? It's hard to even answer, or it's almost impossible to answer that question, because the person who is asking it is dealing, or they're I hate to be disparaging, but they're thinking through that question. They're thinking through the concept of freedom and safety at such a low level that it's very hard to even respond in a way in which they will understand. And I don't mean to sound condescending, but if that's your claim, you really need to understand how little you need to understand how little you understand. You need to know what you don't know. You need to come to the realization that you do not have a very good grasp over this argument at all. If that's your trump card, if that's your silver bullet, that we don't allow people to drink and drive, therefore we should make, we'll call them medicine mandates, mandatory at a federal level. Like that's some mental gymnastics that are so extreme. It just goes to show how little thought or research you're actually putting into that rebuttal. So I don't want to go off on a huge tangent here. I think one of the things I'll do this week on the Rebel Capitalist channel is just take like the top 5 or 10 quote unquote arguments I see on social media for valuing safety over freedom, and just give my rebuttal to each one. Just so, if you guys are having discussions with your friends and family member Fred, that might come in handy. I mean, those rebuttals are so so naive and so ignorant that they're very easy to smash, as Tom Woods would say. But I articulate them from time to time on my live streams, but I don't have a definitive like list as to the top 5 rebuttals that you hear from people who value safety over freedom, and then how to intellectually respond to those with data and facts to make the person, hopefully, if they're being intellectually honest, assuming that that's the case, make them see the error in their thinking. What is the impact of the dismissal of all the workers, medical, government employees that refuse the mandate? What will be the economic fallout? Higher prices, Richard, is one. That's the first thing that comes to my mind. That's kind of a no-brainer because you've got fewer people creating goods and services. You've got the government keeping demand or demand in the form of additional currency units flowing into the economy. Even though the Democrats are kind of bickering and whatnot, it's like, are we going to spend $4 trillion on this next stimulus package or $3 trillion? Okay. At the end of the day, you see M2 money supplier, the dollars that are on the balance sheets of non-bank entities in the real economy, I think going up, just up and to the right. That means more dollars circulating, chasing goods and services. Well, if you have more dollars chasing goods and services, and we have fewer goods and services being created because of these mandates and so many people quitting, then that leads to shortages. That leads to higher prices. And whether it's a computer chip shortage, whether it's, today, that might be in the news. But in the future, if you kind of take this to its logical conclusion, I think that you're going to see power shortages. I think that you're going to see food, unfortunately, shortages. I think that you're going to see a lot of shortages or lack of availability of things in the United States and in the Western world that we have just grown accustomed to having access to whenever we want. We got to think back to the 1970s. Remember the gas lines? Remember you had to wait 2-3 hours in line just to fill up your tank with gas. And I think that's where we're headed. Maybe with gas, maybe not. Maybe with food. I think we'll get there with food. If you look at what they're doing or what they're planning on doing in the name of climate change, and I'm not here to say that climate change is real or fake. I don't want to get into that debate, but the bottom line is the way they're trying to quote unquote tackle this problem is going to lead to less food. That's just, it is what it is. So you may argue that that's on a cost benefit analysis. That's a good thing because the environment is at such risk that if we don't do everything at our disposal to combat the problem, then it'll wipe out humanity in 10 years. And therefore, that if we need to live with less food, then that's just a sacrifice we need to make. That could be your argument. It's not my argument. But if that is, then still the conclusion is we have less food moving forward, especially in the United States, where 5 corporations generate like 90% of our food or something to that degree. And it's not like Ecuador or Colombia. When I've lived there, I've been many places that are kind of out in the sticks. But the good thing about that is that anything that you get in that little, and there's really no grocery stores where I was living in Ecuador. There were just these little huts on the side of the road where you'd get all your vegetables, meat, just kind of everything that you would need. But all of that was grown, I mean, within 5 square miles, especially, or, you know, Colombia, if you've ever been to Medellin, gone up to Guadalupe on the road going up there, you've gone by all those fruits and vegetable stands. And that's where all the restaurants in Medellin are really getting the majority of their produce. So it's all just kind of grown locally. In the United States, we don't have too much of that. So that leaves us very vulnerable. But that's what I'm thinking about personally, Richard, as far whenever I see XYZ mandate and 100 nurses quitting or truck drivers or police officers or whatever, I just think higher prices. I think shortages. I think just more government distortions in the real economy that will lead to a misallocation of resources, malinvestment, and a lower standard of living for all of us moving forward. The other thing I think about is that it's not about health. And I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent here. You guys have heard me talk about this on Twitter constantly, where if you just think about this in a very basic way and look at all their contradictions, especially revolving around, how can I say this to be YouTube friendly? We'll call it the benefits of having the cerveza sickness in the past. that's as YouTube friendly as I can get. I think you guys know what I'm talking about. But in the mainstream media, the politicians, the institutions, they completely ignore this, completely ignore it. And that's really the smoking gun. That tells you that this is not about health. This is about something else. Is it about power? Is it about control? I would argue most likely. Is it about just profits for big pharma? Maybe. That would explain why the attitude is so much different here than even in Europe. I mean, if you look at, I don't like what they're doing in Europe by any stretch of the imagination, but they're far more honest about the cerveza sickness than we are in the United States. As far as the benefits of having the cerveza sickness in the past, and that is pretty much identical, if not better, than getting the medicine. You know, they acknowledge that in Israel. They acknowledge that in Europe. And again, I'm not saying I like what they're doing there overall, but at least they're doing that, which would lead me to believe that they have a slightly more honest approach than we have here in the United States. And it sounds kind of weird to say this, but I would trust, even if I didn't agree with what an institution was saying, I would trust them more if they were acknowledging all the things that should be acknowledged. If you were truly concerned about health, protecting the public, and giving them the tools they need to make good, smart decisions for themselves and their family. Question: did you notice electricity prices in Germany have went up? Less wind is providing less electricity, which caused them to use coal, which then cost carbon credits, cost passed on to consumers. It goes right back to what we were saying. Expect shortages, expect higher energy prices, expect higher food prices, and expect maybe not even having access to expect not even having the same level of access to energy and food, or maybe even housing that you have had in the past, where if you had the money, bam, you've got it. We could get into a world here in the United States where even if you have the money, it doesn't matter. You can't get it. I was listening to a podcast from Grant Williams the other day, and I subscribe to his service, his podcast service. It's very reasonable. It's like $5 a month or something. But he interviewed this gentleman that has been very prolific on Twitter lately. His screen name is Doomberg. Instead of Bloomberg, it's Doomberg. And it's this little chicken for Chicken Little. And he has come out with some great articles. And one that I don't think they've come out with yet, but I was really looking forward to reading it, is on Rolex watches. And I can't recall the title of this interview. I wish I could, because you guys would really get a kick out of it. Or I'm sorry, not the interview, but the paper, which I believe, or the blog post, which I believe is out now. But it was something to the effect of, I can't remember the title, but it was really revolving around just, there's a lot of goods and services today that you could have gotten easily back in 2019 that today you cannot get at any price. And I know this, and it really resonated with me because this is something I've tried to do in the past. So the example that this Doomberg person used was Rolex watches. And you guys know that I'm a big fan of Rolex watches, and not just to wear on your wrist and stuff, but I think it's a great store of value. It's very similar to gold for me. It's like that insurance component of the portfolio. And another thing I really like about Rolex watches is not only do they maintain their value if you know what you're doing when you buy right, But if you've got five or six of them and in a watch case and you throw that in your carry-on bag, I mean, you've got some serious purchasing power that you can just carry with you wherever you go. You can take that to Colombia. You can take that to Dubai. You can take that to Africa. You can take that wherever you want. And I can guarantee you that if you know what you're doing on the buy side and you buy that Rolex for $15,000 or the equivalent in purchasing power, that you could be almost anywhere on the planet in the next 10 years and you could sell it for roughly the same amount of purchasing power. So I bought one the other day. Well, not the other day, but during the Cerveza sickness, prior to going to St. Bart's, and I've been wanting to buy some more, but every single time I go to a shop, you know, just if I happen to be in a mall somewhere, I'll swing by the Rolex store if they've got one and try that. I would challenge you guys, next time you go to a mall, if there's a Rolex store or they sell Rolex at a jeweler there in your local mall, just ask them how many Rolexes they have in stock. Zero. Nada. At any price. You could be Jeff Bezos and walk in there. Warren Buffett. You ain't getting a Rolex. So the only place, I guess, according to this gentleman, he was kind of going over some of the material from his blog post. He was saying that you can only get them on the black market. And in some cases, the Rolex have tripled, quadrupled in price, even regardless of what their retail price is. The retail price is completely insignificant because it just doesn't even matter. It's like price controls, you know, back in the 70s, or, you know, on these black markets where Venezuela or the old Soviet Union, Russia would set a price on jeans as an example. And you couldn't buy them ever at that price. So it was just kind of laughable. The only place you could get them was on the black market at 10 times the price. And we're seeing the exact same thing with Rolex watches right now. And I think my point is, in the future, I think you're going to see that with a lot more than Rolex watches. And my concern is that you're going to see that with food. And hopefully I'm wrong. But you can see it playing out with energy as we speak right now in Germany. And if you want to continue to go down this ESG path, where these governments are using these carbon credits and they're, you know, trying to, in my opinion, buy votes just by pandering to their constituents. And if you think that the politicians really care about the environment or care about your health, I think you're, like I always say, you're lying to yourself more than they lied to you to get your vote in the first place. So I just think that climate change, or I think it's just a Trojan horse for these politicians just to gain more power and control. And I don't think they care about it. They may say they do, but that's just to get your vote or just to manipulate you to give them more power and control over your life. But you can see where this goes. You can see it in Europe right now. You can see it in California. I mean, California, look at all the blackouts they've had. And it's like a third world country with their electrical grid. But yet I read this morning, I think online, that they are now dismantling their last nuclear power plant in California. And again, you may say, George, that's fantastic, because environmentally, that's where we need to go. Okay, if that's your position, that's fine. But what you need to also realize is that we are just going to have a lot less electricity moving forward. And there are no solutions. There are only trade-offs, as Dr. Thomas Sowell teaches us. So if California wants to go green, that's great. That's awesome. You could argue that the air is going to be cleaner. There's less there's a lower probability of them having an issue with the nuclear plant and destroying the environment and doing all the things that we saw in Japan or in Fukushima, I believe it was. And so they're not going to have any risk of that. And the birds are going to be chirping and everyone's going to just be loving the air out in San Francisco, the Bay Area, Los Angeles. They're going to completely beat their problem with solution. That's great. But what is the trade-off? The trade-off is that they're going, if they experience blackouts now, they're going to experience 10 times more blackouts in the future. And if we're moving to this world where everyone's doing business online, again, it's going to be like living in a third world country where there's days that go by that you just can't get the internet. You can't turn on the lights, like Puerto Rico. You know, oh, shoot. Sorry, guys. We're not going to be able to use electricity for the next week. Hope that doesn't interfere with your life. You see, that's the trade-off. That's the discussion that we have to have. To sit there and try to have a discussion that, oh, we just need to go to electricity and everything's going to be fine and great. And the only reason we're not doing that is because these stupid Neanderthal knuckle draggers are just getting in the way because they're paid off by big oil. And they're just so greedy that they're willing to destroy the planet just because of this insatiable greed that they have and a total lack of concern for future generations. And that's the only hurdle that's getting us between where we are today and where we could be next year if we just transferred everything over to wind and solar tomorrow. I mean, that's kind of their mentality. But again, that's going back to that, you know, debate that we had, or the people typically have using driving under the influence of alcohol as a reason why we should value safety more than freedom, or to try to debunk why freedom, that argument is nonsensical. You know, that's what they'll try to use as a rebuttal when I say that freedom is more important, or at least should be a higher priority than safety. That's what they'll always respond with. You know, oh, well, then we should just let people drink and drive. My point is that those are the same people talking, right? Like, that's just as naive as the people who are looking at this energy problem in California and assuming that the only thing that's stopping them from just doing all wind and solar and just having this magical supply of electricity from here to forever, the only thing that's getting in their way are these stupid knuckle draggers that want to destroy the environment. That's just as ignorant as the safety over freedom, driving under the influence of alcohol type of argument.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Are we almost in an environment where gold, silver stocks could actually rise? Well, so I don't know that that's the question I try to answer, because that goes back to trying to figure out if something's price is going to go up or down. And I don't know that that's a good idea. We got to go back to blackjack. So the question we're trying to answer, if you're looking, at least I try to answer when I look at an asset, is, we'll use gold and silver stocks. Are gold and silver stocks cheap right now? If yes, then I buy. If no, then I don't buy, or I sell. Or if they're expensive, then I sell. I don't ask a question where you're trying to figure out, are the prices going to go up in the next couple months? Are the prices going to go down in the next couple months? If I start off with those questions, I make really bad decisions. But if I just simply start off with the cheap or expensive question, then I tend to make very good decisions in the long run. And I think that's your edge. And that's what goes back to blackjack and understanding the probabilities and the necessity to have that edge. So I think that there's a good argument for gold and silver stocks being cheap and being unloved. And therefore, I'm personally putting them on a watch list. But again, I want to be clear. I'm not putting them on my personal watch list because I think we're in an environment where they could actually go up. Meaning that I'm trying to predict the price move and therefore making investment decisions around those predictions. I am simply putting them on a watch list because I think that they are getting cheap. And so that's hopefully the difference between those two lines of thinking makes sense. What was really in that bottle? Oh, just water. I'll give these guys a quick plug. This is really good water, but I just I always like drinking water out of a glass. I don't like drinking it out of plastic. I just not to go off on a tangent, but the level of testosterone in the male population in the United States has plummeted since I was a kid, and you can see it. You can see it the way guys look today. And I hate to just lump everyone into the same category. And obviously there are exceptions, but men just look a lot different. They look far more effeminate than they did when I was growing up. And I think you could say, well, that's because they're just being themselves. Maybe. But I think it has a lot to do with the testosterone levels being extraordinarily low as far as the average relative to where they have been throughout history. So you ask why? Well, I mean, I'm sure there's several reasons, but I think one reason maybe is the plastic stuff. And I just, I just don't like plastic. So if I can get water out of a glass bottle. I much prefer to do that because I like my testosterone levels to stay where they are. Thank you very much. I have no desire to be feminized or to wear skinny jeans and have a man bun and carry around some sort of Paris Hilton dog in my fanny pack. All right. Let's see. $1 trillion platinum coin. Are they this dumb or do they think we are that dumb? How to answer this question. On paper, that works. I know Krugman came up with that. So I never read the paper where he suggested that, or maybe it was an interview. So I don't want to take it out of context because if, and this is a big if, he was just saying that by creating this $1 trillion coin, it would just give the Fed some sort of asset on their balance sheet so they wouldn't be insolvent if they created an extra $1 trillion worth of liabilities, dollar-denominated liabilities in the form of bank reserves that go into the TGA that the government can actually spend out to reduce their debt to GDP or create stimulus checks. And keep in mind, this was prior to 2019. Now $1 trillion coin would be worthless. I mean, who cares that the government's spending that in the next 2 weeks? So it wouldn't be a $1 trillion coin. It would have to be like a $10 trillion coin to move the needle. I mean, that's the insanity of the world we live in now. But it's not that you could do that in practice and it wouldn't have some serious unintended consequences. And so the probability of them doing that is low. I don't know if I would say it's dumb though, because I don't know that it's any dumber than what they're currently doing. But I guess you could categorize that as dumb. And what I mean by that is They're just, think about what a treasury is, or a mortgage-backed security even. It's not anything tangible. It's not something you can drink. It's not something you can eat. It's not this roof over my head. All it is a contract. It's just in the form of treasury. We'll use that as an example. It's just the government saying they're going to give you X amount of dollars in the future. It's basically an IOU. And what are they saying they owe you? They owe you dollars. Well, what are dollars? Well, dollars are IOUs. So all a treasury is the government saying, we owe you IOUs. Is that any more insane than, and then that's the asset on the Fed's balance sheet? So we can create $1 trillion worth of IOU IOUs, and the Fed can buy those for $1 trillion, and that's the asset on their balance sheet. And then therefore they create $1 trillion of liabilities, dollar denominated bank reserves that go into the TGA, that Janet Yellen can therefore go and spend into the real economy. But look at that asset. Is that any less ridiculous than a $1 trillion platinum coin? I mean, I don't know. I mean, it gets to the point where it's all fugazis. So is one fugazi better than the other fugazi? I don't know. But I think you're right in saying that it's dumb. But let's not forget that the whole entire system is dumb. The whole entire system is insane. It doesn't make any sense. It's just we've become so accustomed to it that we see it as normal. But if you had like space aliens come down from another planet and they saw that system, they would say, what on earth are these humans doing? We thought that there was intelligent life here. I guess we were wrong. Lloyd Christmas running the financial system. Yeah. Exactly. Lloyd Christmas. Was that the best movie of all time or what? Dumb and Dumber. Fantastic movie. All right, guys. I'm going to go ahead and leave you there so I can get off to my member live stream. Again, definitely check out rebelcapitalistlive.com. If you guys are on the fence, trust me, you're going to absolutely love the event. The one we had in Miami sold out about a month and a half prior to the event. So make sure that you get your tickets now. You're going to absolutely love it. I hate to say it'll change your life, but it could. I mean, we're living in dangerous times right now. And I don't think there's ever been a time, at least in my life, where it's been more important to be cognizant of the world around you when it comes to macro, your finances, politics, but also what affects or what could affect your personal freedom and liberty. And you guys know that I've made a strong push on the Rebel Capitalist channel, and I've rented space from Kiyosaki. I've set up a studio over there. As of the last couple of weeks, I've been cranking out like 2, 3, sometimes 4 pieces of content every single day on that channel. I mean, right now between the George Gammon channel and the Rebel Capitalist channel, I'm producing about 20 to 25 pieces of content per week. And the reason I'm doing that is because I believe that our freedoms are under attack. And I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that I stand up and fight for liberty and freedom and make sure I open people's eyes as to why they should value freedom over safety and why that's important and why we should be against censorship and why we should be against big government. And in making these arguments in a logical way that really resonates with people, so we can move the needle and we can get off the path to serfdom. The road to serfdom is what we're on right now. And we can get off that path. But this is an individual effort that I'm making along with my employees. But I can't do it by myself. It needs to be a team. We need to do this together. We need to do this as a community. And if we think back to how the Berlin Wall came down, and that was the discussion that I've mentioned, that I've articulated many times on this channel, the discussion I had with my good friend Gerald Celente. And he pointed this out. He said, George, the way the wall came down is you had a bunch of Germans go out there and they said, you know, we're fed up with this. We're done. We value freedom more than safety. You want to go ahead and shoot me? Shoot me. But we're going to come out here and stand by this wall until there is a change. And then more people went out to the wall, more people and more people and more people and more people, till they got to a point where there was thousands of German citizens that were standing up for freedom for every one guard there with a gun. And if you're a guard, what are you going to do? You're going to shoot someone? That would bring your life expectancy down to about 3 minutes, because that mob is going to rip you apart. And I'm not condoning violence in any way, shape, or form, but I am telling you the story of how the Berlin Wall came down. It was because there was more of us than there was of them. And how I'm using that is there were more people in Germany that valued freedom and liberty than there were dictators, than there were authoritarians, than there were guards with guns. And as a community, they brought down that wall together. And I think that we can do that today. We can bring down this Berlin Wall that is being constructed around us as we speak. But we can only do it together. And so that's why I think another reason why Rebel Capitalist Live is so crucial to attend, to really get that sense of community. And, you know, it's a meeting of the minds, and not just with the speakers, but with the attendees, even more so with the attendees. So we can all get together and not only get motivated, but also learn from each other and figure out how we're going to win this fight and how we're going to win this war. And I don't think there's any time in at least my lifetime where this has been more important. So check that out at Rebel Capitalist Live. And let me do some shout outs here. We've got RR in the house, Mexi Mike, Stephen Lewis, Matt Bell, Mark Worley, IC, Wayne Smith, Chazza, Truth, Swear Works, Goat Farmer, All Nighter Hider in the house, Legacies, Carlo Laboni, Iboni maybe, Chris K, Freedom Stacker, Susan the Patriot, Rule Zero Media, Carmack Guerin, Jason Kincaid. All right, guys, enjoy the rest of your evening. We'll see you in the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.